Welcome to episode 162 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and this episode's guest is Glenn Eric Hamilton, whose Mercy River, the fourth in the Van Shaw series of mysteries, has just been published. From Mercy River, Glenn takes former Army Ranger Van Shaw away from his comfort zone of Seattle and its environs to the high desert plains of Central Oregon to help a friend and former fellow soldier, Leo Pack, who's been arrested for murder. It's a dicey enough case, made even more complicated by the annual rally, an event that brings a veritable army of current and former Rangers to town to celebrate and commemorate. Here's Glenn Hamilton to talk about Mercy River. Thank you for joining Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and on the podcast today is Glenn Eric Hamilton, whose Mercy River, his fourth Van Shaw mystery, has just been published. Welcome, Glenn.
Hi, good morning, Nancy.
Yesterday, I read your piece in Crime Reads about the location scouting trip you took to Central Oregon with your nine-year-old daughter. So perhaps the setting for Mercy River is a good place to start. Your previous novels center in and around Seattle, including Way Out on the Water. What about Central Oregon beckoned you as a setting for a book?
There's a couple reasons. One is, of course, to get Van out of his regular haunts and kind of shake up his comfort zone and my own and write about new places. Central Oregon is a really unique and amazing place. It's not the Pacific Northwest a lot of people think of. It's not covered in huge forest and covered in drizzling rain all the time. A lot of it is high plains desert, much of it above the snow line or close to it. It's very arid. It does have forests down in the lowlands, but it's got a lot of upper reaches as well where the rock formations and volcanic activity has been heavy for centuries and eons, and that's formed some amazing lands around there. There's also, as you noted in the article, a prevalence of abandoned homesteads and ghost towns and things of that nature, which makes for some pretty evocative places.
And I thought melancholy was a constant companion to action in this book. There's plenty of Van Shaw action. And although not a lot of time has gone by since the series began 4 books ago, Van has become older and wiser. And in spite of being richer, which we learned about in the last book, he's sadder. Is that true, or am I just imagining it?
Yeah, I think Van's, you're very astute to note that the books aren't happening in real time. This is the fourth book, but it's by no means the fourth year that Van has been back, largely because I didn't want to age him up that quickly during the crucial transition period when he's out of the military and reestablishing himself as a civilian. And so really only about a little less than 2 years has passed since he's left the service and since the original adventures. And so I don't know if melancholy is exactly the word I would use. I would think that Van has had to come to face some hard truths about the fact that, okay, I can't just live for tomorrow the way that I used to, and you know, focus only on today and getting through today and surviving whatever mission or sortie the regiment is going out on. I have to start taking control of my life and thinking longer terms. And he's discovered that he's not quite as adept at that as he is at survival. I always say that Van is great at surviving, but not so great at living his life.
He is an ex-Army Ranger. And he's called to Central Oregon, to the town of Mercy River, by his friend and former fellow ranger, Leo Pack. And once there, he finds the town is the site of a weekend-long gathering of rangers, past, currently enlisted and ex-rangers. And it's an uplifting concept, this gathering, which they call the rally. But it also had tinges of melancholy for me as well. You know, the town looks to the hopefully annual event as an economic shot in the arm. You mentioned that this Central Oregon area is not as economically robust as the Pacific Northwest or Portland. And to the soldiers look at it as a validation of the sacrifice they've made. And to some, it's an opportunity to disguise misdeeds, and specifically the murder of one Earl Sharple, which sets off the story.
Right, exactly. It's the town is pretty ambivalent about the rally coming in every year. I think at first they were welcomed with open arms for a variety of reasons, including economic. There's other reasons the rally was welcomed that we discover during the course of the book. But there's also a bit of a deal with the devil in the fact that the person with the money tends to make the rules, and the rally, which is both the weekend gathering every year for special operations personnel, but it's also the name of the charitable foundation that drives it annually and the purpose for it. The rally swings a lot of weight in town, and that doesn't always sit well with the locals, who do see it as, understandably, as something of an invasion.
And an invasion by professional soldiers, which makes it, you know, even more dicey, I would think.
A literal invasion by hundreds of heavily armed, very well-trained individuals, yes. Mm-hmm.
And Earl Sharple is, am I pronouncing his name correctly, Earl Sharple?
Sharples, yes.
Sharples. We never meet him. He's dead immediately. He's introduced as a corpse, but I thought he was interesting too. He was not a well liked fellow, you know, prickly, I guess would be the way one other character described him, and he's the local gun seller. I mean, legitimate. And, you know, he has a gun shop, he sells ammo, and so he gets to know a lot of these guys. And I'm curious why you made him dead from the beginning, why we didn't really get a chance to meet him.
Well, somebody had to be dead. That's the inciting incident, of course, is that there's been a murder. So there had to be some sort of corpse. But also just because I wanted Earl to have some complexity to him and not just be this beloved figure who was killed, but rather somebody whose own relationship with the town might be a little complex. Back to kind of our idea of money swinging weight, Earl has some money in this town, and although he's not a well-liked figure, he was a very influential figure in the town for a variety of reasons. As a result, the question of who might have wanted him dead gets a little more challenging along the way. Also, just because I sort of liked the idea of Earl and his shop being kind of a locus center for things that aren't quite what they seem in the town. Earl does run a legitimate gun shop. Earl also does other things that we discover during the course of the story.
And therein lies the problem. Also, because you did mention he's a wealthy guy with money. There are more than one person that might want him dead, which of course makes the story interesting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You definitely want the classic Agatha Christie phenomenon is his lordship is dead, and everyone has a reason for it.
Army Rangers, like all the Armed Services Special Forces, they're a breed apart. And I'm curious how much research you did into the Rangers to first create the character Van, and second, to populate a gathering of them, you know, that are both active duty and retired, enlisted, and officers. Was there a lot of research involved? Did you talk to them and immerse yourself in them?
Yeah, I did a lot of research when first creating Van, and then I returned to that research and built upon it specifically for Mercy River because it dealt so much with the Ranger community along the way. And while I wasn't getting into great detail into the active Ranger community and what life is like on base, for example, or between deployments, I do have friends and contacts, a couple of whom are noted in the acknowledgments, who are willing to talk in detail about their lives as Rangers, both when they were active and now that they've returned to the States along the way. There was a lot of research into what it takes to become a Ranger, literally in the assessment and selection process, which was, when Van went through it, was called RASP and is now called RIP, Ranger Indoctrination Process, I think, which is the multi-week, essentially, trial by fire that soldiers go through in order to be Ranger qualified and be available for selection therein. And so I did a ton of homework on that, both reading online, looking at, in this age, you can look at a lot of YouTube videos by current and former Rangers about their life, talking to former Rangers as well and doing a lot of reading. There's an excellent book that I'll recommend called Sue Esponte by, Dick Couch. I was worried I was going to blank on his name there. Dick Couch has written, his former military himself, and he's written a number of books about different branches of the service. And Sue Esponte is specifically about the Ranger selection process and Ranger school, which are different things, which goes into tremendous detail, and it's been a font of great information for me on that. And so I will read those things and I will double check them against real people and say, hey, is this still accurate? Is this the way it goes? Mostly what I'm looking for is the right spirit, the right mindset for Van and for the men around him who have been through that.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting to read, one of the little parts of the book I thought was interesting, and I can talk about this, it's not in anywhere a spoiler, is when Van discovers, when he gets to Mercy River, that this rally is going to take place, and he recognizes fellow Rangers simply by their haircut and sort of the cut of their jib, how they walk and how they dress, is he recollects a similar gathering when he was still in Ranger school, I guess, and getting so drunk he couldn't see and having the officer come and rescue them from the police and bringing them back to base and the suffering thereafter. I thought that was just it was a side of Van I guess I hadn't seen, and I've read all four books, so a recollection of Van as a wild and crazy guy, because one thing he's wild and crazy, but not at the same time as an older guy. This was when he was young. He was wild and crazy at the same time.
Yeah, he's the incident you're talking about. He's 19. He's just passed the Ranger selection process and is waiting for placement within the Ranger Regiment, the 75th Regiment. He and the other prospective Ranger candidates, along with a lot of other soldiers, have a party at the local river off base, and things get out of hand. And Van is very drunk, and so the major in question takes them out, cuts them out from the herd, takes them back to base. They get about 2 hours of sleep, and then they're ushered out of bed, and they're made to suffer for the next day, and suffer they do. And that's their own brand of punishment, right? They're not going to get away with this, but their military careers aren't going to suffer either, because they really haven't done anything wrong except raise a little hell, right? They haven't destroyed anything. They haven't hurt anybody. But they're definitely going to feel it for not living up to standards.
And obviously remember it.
And they're going to remember it next time, absolutely.
Other familiar faces to your series, in addition to Leo, are back, including Van's former girlfriend, Luce, and Dono, his grandfather's old buddy and former partner in crime, Hollis. They help Van because Van is a good guy, but the help to Van comes at a psychic cost. So by the end of the book, I felt that Van had a conflicted relationship with the notion of being at peace. I mean, not that he was He's not anywhere near there. But just the idea of it, just the notion of being at peace. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems like he's trying to get there and it's difficult for him. Is that accurate, or am I once again just going way off the deep end?
No, I think you're getting to one of the fundamental themes of the book, which is, you know, how does somebody who's very good at being a warrior, and in Van's case, he's also very good at crime, and you know, ironically, his military experience both gave him a moral center, but also gave him the discipline and the skills to be a much better criminal than his grandfather ever was or could be. And these things that he's very, very good at, how do you reconcile that with a peaceful life? And I don't think Van is sure that he wants a peaceful life at this point. I think he's coming to that realization that it isn't going to be about settling in and having a regular job and a regular life, because that may not be what he's destined for.
It's also does it, his skill set. You know, we should mention for those who haven't read previous books that Van's grandfather, Donovan Shaw, for whom he's named, was also a master criminal who taught Van his skills of breaking in and observation and strategizing most thefts. He's a natural. That's where his talents are, and that can be conflicting to somebody, I would think.
Yes, absolutely. You know, Van has got a strong sense of justice. He's no longer the person who could rip off a mansion or steal from a business without thinking of the human cost behind that. Right? He can't set that aside the way Donna would never even consider it. Really, it wouldn't really be part of his reasoning at all. But Van, in addition to having that moral center, is just very good tactically, strategically, and with his skill set at doing that. And which is why I think he tends to find himself in these situations is he gets wind of something that someone that needs help or something that needs doing, and I don't think he can really help himself. There's a part of him that is drawn to that very strongly.
And he can't look at it and say, oh, I can't do this, because he can.
Because he can, exactly right. Like, someone has to do something, and, well, I'm here.
And I want to.
And I want to. Yes, exactly right.
You are one of the many crime fiction writers who also work full-time in a non-writing field. And by that, I mean, you know, there are crime fiction writers who teach writing and are English and, you know, teach English lit or something along those lines. And I'm always curious about that, because the discipline you need to do the work with all the compelling competition for your time. And I should mention, you're also the president of the Southern California chapter of Mystery Writers of America. So you have a more than full plate. And I'm just wondering how you do it. How do you turn out a book, I believe, about once a year, have a full-time job, you have a family, and devote additional time to the organization that represents you as a mystery writer?
Well, thank you, by the way, along the way. It's funny, whenever you hear a list like that of the things that you're doing, you realize, oh, yeah, I guess I am doing a lot. But it's sort of like the frog in the boiling water, right? you may not realize you're in it at the time. And this is a particularly busy period. I'm in my second year as president of our Mystery Writers of America chapter. It's sort of in a groove now. I know how to do the job, so it's a little easier than it was last year, which does help. One is that I'm very good at time management, as you might guess. My days are quite full. There's not a lot of downtime. There's not a lot of TV time, things like that. But we do try to get it onto a schedule where I can make the time for that, make the time to hang out with the family and things like that. And the family itself is a tremendous help. I mean, they keep things running so that those few weeks, a couple of times a year, when Dad has to go to work, start writing, come home at 10:30 at night, eat the food that's on the plate, go to sleep, get up and do it again, you know, for a few weeks every day, they're there keeping the world spinning, you know, while I'm in my head making these characters. And so it's a very literal fact that I could not do this without them. If I did not have the family, it's not like I would have more time. I think I would have less time.
That's fantastic.
It's very much the Anne Lamott approach of bird by bird, right? Where you just do a couple pages at a time here and there, and some of it too is learning how to write a book, which is a very different thing than writing a short story and writing other things. Is, you know, some writers just sit down and write. Some writers have to outline the whole thing, and learning how you approach that is really the school of it that you're going through, whether you're doing that with a writing group or a class or just on your own, that you figure out. And once you figure it out how you write best, it does, I wouldn't say that the writing itself gets easier, but you worry about those aspects of it less.
Well, I'm definitely in awe, and I think a lot of other writers are too. You know, you're not alone. I can think Rachel Hall, I know, also has a full-time job, not in a strictly writing field, and also turns out about a book a year. But it's not easy, and the tremendous amount of credit, I think, goes to you and your brethren and sisterin.
Thank you.
I'm assuming we leave Van in the usual ambiguity at the end of this book, and I'm not going to go out on a limb here with the assumption that in his next book he won't be riding unicorns, right? He's going to have another challenge.
Right. Yeah, Van will retire to raise goats in order. No. No. Actually, I've got about a fifth or a quarter of Van's next adventure written already and submitted to the publisher, and we're going to be hopefully discussing book deals soon for that. I was a little late getting that finished because I drafted it and I discussed it with my agent, and then I got a better idea, as often happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get a better idea, you can't go back to the old one anymore. You've got to write that one. So I went and wrote that one, which took a couple extra weeks. But I was very glad I did, and so turned that into my agent. My agent has turned into my editor, and I'm hoping that we'll be discussing that within the next week or so. So I've got about a fifth of that going, and I'm very excited about the next book too. It'll continue on from Van's thought processes at the end of Mercy River, but Van is going to have some pretty radical changes in his life, and I'm excited about those.
Well, and I'm excited that they're coming. So, Glenn, thanks again. I know you're off for your book tour, so congratulations. That's the fun part. It's actually fun and scary, I think, isn't it?
I think if I was more of an introvert, it would be scary, but if you know all of those, the tests like the Myers-Briggs and stuff and everything else that they often put you through in corporate America, that are sort of personality indicators, if not tests. I'm always right on the line between introvert and extrovert. I'm right down the middle, which means I go and I get a lot of energy from other people, and then I have to go away and use that before I explode, before it's too much. And then I get depleted, and then I have to go hang out with other people and get energy again. Book tours are the fun part, the fun reward that comes from producing the book, all the lonely time that comes from producing the book, is then you get to go out and you get to talk to readers and you get to do podcasts like this one and you get to go to conventions, you know, and talk about not just your book, but everybody's book, you know, the stuff that they're working on. And that's very energizing. It's a lot of fun. I've got a couple of appearances in and around Seattle, and then I'll be at Left Coast Crime in Vancouver. And then in April, early April, I'll have appearances down here in Orange County in the San Diego area at Book Carnival and at Warwick's and at Mysterious Galaxy in the first couple weeks of April. And if folks are interested, they can find all that on my website, glennerichamilton.com. But it's really about the most fun, honestly, is about talking to fans of the genre, because I'm a fan of the genre, and it's just fun to talk about murder and mayhem in books that we love.
Especially because all of you are such nice people, and there's absolutely no irony in that statement.
No. I'll tell a little story. When my first book, Past Crimes, was nearly ready to send out, I went to Thriller Fest in New York, which was really my first convention. I'd gone to a California crime writers convention some years before, just briefly, but I didn't really know anybody, so I was just sort of hanging out. But I went to Thriller Fest just to get some practice pitching it. And what sold me, not just on writing, but on wanting to be a part of this community, was everyone, from established authors to neophytes like myself, was so warm and so welcoming and so much fun to hang out with and so encouraging that, like, okay, this is a group of people you want to see 3-4 times a year at conventions. This is just too much fun. These people are great. I've made some really fast friends in the past 5 years or so of going to these conferences. And it's just a spectacular community. And so if anyone has interest in writing or interest as a fan, if you're a big reader of mysteries and you've never been to a convention like a Left Coast Crime or VoucherCon or Crime Bake in New England or Sleuth Fest or any of the others, there's a ton of them, and there's regional ones and national ones. I really strongly encourage you to try one out, because you will probably have a terrific time and make a ton of new friends.
Well, with that, we'll say thank you for joining us, Glenn, and thank you for writing Mercy River. And we look forward to talking to you next year with the next book.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nancy. Great to talk to you.